Coming up on Philosophy Talk, the occult philosophy.
A blend of metaphysics, magic, and theology.
Perhaps I've been wrong to blindly follow the medical traditions and superstitions of the past centuries.
In Elizabethan times, many of the best minds in Europe believed in the occult.
Maybe we barbers should test those assumptions analytically through experimentation and a scientific method.
The study of the occult helped give birth to modern science.
Perhaps this scientific method could be extended to other fields of learning, the natural sciences, art, navigation.
From astrology to astronomy, from alchemy to chemistry,
from witchcraft to medicine.
Perhaps I could lead the way to a new age, an age of rebirth, a renaissance.
What does belief in the occult signify in the 21st century?
Our guest is Christopher Lyric from Boston University.
Say, who's the barber here?
The occult philosophy. After the news.
Each day, millions of people go to sleep hungry.
Hungry for new ideas, new approaches, new thinking, new philosophies.
But they have nowhere to turn.
That's where you, our audience, comes in. For a small donation to Philosophy Talk, you can help enlighten others.
For the cost of one cup of coffee per day, you can help keep Philosophy Talk on the air and online.
Go donate now at philosophytalk.org.
And help feed this hunger for thought. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the occult philosophy.
Well, Ken, these days we think of believers in the occult as soft-minded, superstitious, New Age hippie types. People who would rather commune with imaginary mystical forces than face cold, hard scientific facts.
You know, that's right, John, but it wasn't always so. During the Renaissance, for example, things like alchemy, astrology, white magic, hermeticism, Kabbalah, numerology, these things were intensely studied and by some of the best minds in Europe. High literature from the period is even rife with references to the occult. The works of Shakespeare are a prime example.
So what you're saying is the occult was once culturally dominant in parts of Europe. And although today it's culturally marginalized as anti-scientific gobbledygook, many historians of science, as I understand you, believe the study of the occult played a crucial role in the development of modern science itself.
So alchemy begat chemistry and astrology begat astronomy. But how so? How could that happen?
Well, think about the meaning of the word occult.
Well, according to my dictionary, it means of, relating to, or dealing with supernatural influences, agencies, or phenomena. That's very different from the stuff that science deals with, the opposite of what science deals with.
Yeah, but occult has another meaning, Ken, an older meaning. Secret, concealed, or hidden from view, as in occult causes.
You're right. That's an old-fashioned meaning of the word. You find it used that way a lot in 16th and 17th century philosophy texts. Hume talks about occult causes, for example. But I don't think many people use the word occult to mean secret or hidden very much today.
Yeah, but they did then, and to the extent that Renaissance students of the occult were trying to discover and manipulate the hidden causes of everything in the universe, their goals were quite in line with modern science.
Yeah, but their methods were weird, John. It was a witch's brew of religious mysticism, metaphysical speculation of all kinds, and magic.
So basically, Renaissance thinkers, or at least a lot of them, thought that hidden occult causes, in the respectable sense, were also weird supernatural occult causes.
Right. And, you know, there's another thing. Occult also means for the adept only, secret knowledge in that sense, not to secret causes, but secret knowledge, and only the adept could learn because you had to be worthy. So, you know, although occult science and philosophy of the Renaissance may have been the forerunners of modern science, they weren't very scientific by today's standards. Modern science has no truck with all that supernatural stuff and hidden secret causes and secret knowledge only for a few.
Well, I don't know. I think quantum physics is kind of a cult secret, and I'm certainly not one of the few that can understand it. But setting that aside, eventually science superseded occult practices and drove them into the shadows.
And it wasn't just science that drove them in the shadows. There was an intense religious backlash against the occult, especially, as I understand it, after the Protestant Reformation. The occult philosophy drew liberally not just from Christian theology, but from all pagan sources, Egyptian stuff, Greek stuff, and Eastern beliefs. I guess it was a highly unorthodox mix, and probably threatening to both the Protestant and the Catholic Church.
The occult became identified with dark and sinister forces. Its practitioners were subject to intense religious persecution. They were often tortured and executed. Some historians even refer to the numerous witch-hunting crazes of the period as kind of a mini Holocaust.
You know, John, despite the dismissive attitude of people who may be overawed by science, some apparently sane people still believe in the occult. And thankfully for them and for us, we don't burn people at the stake anymore for practicing, you know, a little witchcraft.
So where are we going with this, Ken?
Well, I was just listing some of the reasons why there couldn't be a better thing for us to be doing today than asking where our ideas of the occult come from and examining how those ideas got driven from the center of Western culture to its margins. It should be a fun and fascinating hour.
But since neither you nor I is very adept at occult practices, we should conjure ourselves up some help.
And fortunately, we need only the white magic of radio to do that. And we've already got one of the world's leading experts on the occult standing by.
That would be Christopher Lyric from Boston University, author of The Occult Mind, Magic and Theory in Practice. He'll join us in just a little bit.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Angela Kilduff, found some modern-day believers in the occult. She files this report.
Put a little bit of oil in this.
And what's the oil for?
The oil is a dressing oil. It kind of wakes it up and says, okay.
At Ancient Ways, a pagan metaphysical store in Oakland, Marilee Bigelow is dressing a blue and yellow birthday candle for a customer.
So we've talked about prosperity, right? So lots of money in there.
Bigelow sprinkles confetti and glitter on the candle.
Of course, the cross for protection, and also sort of the crossroads, you know, saying, okay, here I am, and I'm ready to take that next step. So everybody needs a little luck, right? Yeah.
I came to Ancient Ways to learn about the occult community, and what I found surprised me.
What I practice is leukemia. It has many names. Some call it Ifa, some call it Santeria.
Officially identified within the leukemia spirituality from Nigeria, my belief system is very huge. Pretty much any positive energy, deity, force within this universe, I worship. You know, if it's positive, I'm for it.
The occult community in the Bay Area is diverse. It draws from Southern hoodoo traditions, African, Egyptian, and neo-pagan beliefs. Store owner Glenn Turner.
Generally speaking, people are polytheistic. They may think of an overarching God that would be like a unity. But in specifics, just like the Catholics have saints, the specifics are that there's many sections and many gods that would be worked with.
Turner opened the store 22 years ago and has been involved with pagan spirituality and the occult for more than 40 years. She founded a witchcraft tradition and organizes Pantheacon, an annual convention that attracts more than 2,000 neo-pagans.
And that's the earth religions that would include things like candomblé, witchcraft, ceremonial magic.
More and more people are being drawn to the occult. Wicca is a neo-pagan, nature-based religion. In a national survey of religious identity in 2008, nearly 350,000 Americans identified as Wiccan. In 1990, that figure was only 8,000.
The occult means hidden. The hidden things are not known by science. So what's happened is that science has sorted out all the things we can see that we can know. That kind of leaves a smaller and smaller bundle of things that are not known. And many of those things are put aside saying, well, those are not real. So there's almost a connotation of phony or fake.
Two examples she gave are ghosts and telepathy.
These may turn out to be things that are scientifically viable once we get the right approach.
Ancient Ways stock statues, books, herbs, candles, and other magical tools, and the air is heavy with incense. There are brooms, Buddhas, and magic wands made by a witch in Santa Cruz, a hit with the Harry Potter fans.
Very charming to see a mother come in with her youngster, you know, and he's picking out his wand here, and that was really fun to see.
But for many, these are sacred objects.
The truth of it is that a magical wand is a focal point. And anytime you have something you can focus on, I mean, for some people it would be a cross sitting on an altar in their home. Other people it might be a pentacle. Other people they might take hold of their magical wand and use it to focus their energy for something and then mentally send it out through that like a fire hose, so to speak.
What happens next is a matter of faith.
My theory of how that would work is that what comes out of the fire hose goes out into the ether, which is a non-material, non-scientific area, but it's a way of explaining, how does this go to someone to heal them? I don't know, but it works.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Angela Kilduff.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Christopher Larrick. He's a professor of religion at Boston University. He's author of The Occult Mind, Magic in Theory and Practice. Christopher, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So, Christopher, tell us briefly what drove you to think, write, and research about the occult mind. I mean, you're not an occult practitioner yourself, are you?
I'm not, actually, no.
Okay.
So what's the basis of your interest in this topic?
Well, I've always thought it was sort of interesting, and I got interested in the early modern intellectual world. And one of the things that you notice immediately is that occult and magical and alchemical and so forth ideas are everywhere. And until relatively recently, scholars had really no idea what to make of any of it. So that seemed like a good in. And then working on it, I continue to find it fascinating.
So when we go back and look at the people that were both philosophers and occultists, I guess there's a huge body of work. But could you identify a couple of the main tenets of a couple of the leading occult philosophers?
Sure. I think occult philosophy, I mean, first of all, it's a style more than it is a particular school. But occult philosophy is really an attempt to recapture a supposedly lost ancient wisdom that was known, let's say, to Adam in the Garden of Eden, and to do this by bringing together every possible form of knowledge into one vast, coherent system. So it's really a totalizing sense of knowledge.
So Adam's knowledge from the Garden of Eden, which is, I read something, Adam went around naming everything, right? I mean, so Adam kind of knew everything, and I guess he spoke in Hebrew or something like that?
Well, that depends on who you ask, actually. Certainly that's a fairly common notion, but there are others who will say that he spoke in the Adamic language, mm-hmm. and that Hebrew, like every other language, comes from the shattering at the Tower of Babel. The crucial thing about Adam, the nomothete, as they say, the one who names everything, is that as he names the things, so they are. I mean, these names are not arbitrary terms in a language as we know it. They're somehow locked to the objects that are named.
Right. So they're like the original names, which are intrinsic to the thing, and by discovering them, we get power over them. So that's one source.
Yes.
But then I understand the Egyptians and the Greeks had some role in this too, right?
Well, sure. I mean, there are various theories of why exactly, but the usual thing is that there's some sort of a trajectory that comes from Adam and Noah and so forth, and this knowledge gets fragmented, and different groups of people end up preserving different parts of this fragmented knowledge. So the Egyptians, especially Hermes Trismegistus, you know, the great supposed founder of everything, he has this whole Egyptian wisdom, which eventually Plato will bastardize later. And then Moses, of course, has the knowledge that comes down that way, and that gets passed down and turns into Kabbalah and on like this, and the Greeks
so,
as well.
So are there some familiar names to those of us who read and teach philosophy who bought into this from the Renaissance or later?
Yes. I mean, Newton, for one.
Oh, dear.
Newton was an occultist?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Most of the people you probably don't teach so much because it's sort of a lost subsection. That is to say, the revival of Neoplatonism in the late 15th century, Marsilio Ficino and so forth. I mean, this is tremendously influential on everybody, but modern philosophy has a tendency to skip this part of the history and sort of say, well, you know, in this period, let's talk about Descartes and then let's go on to Hume and so on.
So how about
there
these
is the
Cambridge Platonists? Were they into the occult?
Who are you guys referring
sure,
to?
Absolutely.
Who are the Cambridge Platonists?
Well, they were kind of contemporaries of Newton, weren't they?
A little earlier, but yeah, roughly. Uh-huh.
So the occult. So okay. So there was all this stuff going back to Adam and the Egyptians and the ancient Greeks, and they believed something about the interconnectedness of the divine sphere. And then, I mean, what is all that? I mean, okay, science believes in hidden causes, but it doesn't do all this magic. I mean, where does all this magic and all this religious stuff come from?
Well, in a
Briefly.
Sense, you've got it the wrong way around. I mean, it's when does it get precipitated out? I think in a lot of early modern thought, there is a notion there's no intrinsic division. There's no intrinsic way to say, well, I'm studying nature, and so I'm not studying God. I mean, nature is the book of is one of the two books written by God. So if we're going to read the book of nature, we're, of course, inquiring into the mind of God. So there's no intrinsic line there. That really doesn't come until well into the 18th century that it really gets solidified that there's such a distinction.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing the occult philosophy with Christopher Larrick, author of The Occult Mind, Magic in Theory and Practice.
Are you a believer in the occult? Are you an adept practitioner of ancient occult practices? Do you think hidden supernatural forces govern our lives? Or do you think that supernatural ideas in the occult are just a soft-minded and superstitious bunch of baloney?
Probing the hidden reaches of the occult, when Philosophy Talk continues.
I'll put a spell on you. Because you're mad, mad, mad. Oh, 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 you're mad.
This is a supernatural edition of Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about the occult philosophy of the Renaissance. So is there really something to ancient occult practices? Are they relevant today? Or do you think these ideas are just for the superstitious and the credulous?
Our guest is Christopher Larrick, author of The Occult Mind, Magic in Theory and Practice.
So, Christopher, we were talking a little bit about the main tenets of some of the occult philosophies and practices, and we just sort of started to get into this question I want to ask you. Would you call a belief in the occult, as I'm not talking about now, but then, would you call the belief in the occult part of an anti-scientific, irrational mindset? I mean, what was the mindset of these people? How would we characterize their mindset?
Well, again, the occult as something distinct isn't—that's really a later characterization, except in occasional very pejorative context. But you think of Kepler or Newton and their fascination with Pythagorean number progressions. You think of Newton's alchemical work as an attempt to grapple with gravity. You can say it's unscientific, but I mean, it's Newton after all.
So what you're saying is that we don't look for the occult as a special subset of unusually weird thinkers, scientists, and philosophers of this time. It's more or less the default. It's surprising if somebody isn't a little bit occult. How about Galileo? I remember reading that Galileo didn't get around to reading Kepler because he was put off by all the sun worship and that stuff.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was quite as mainstream as you make it sound. Certainly there are people, Galileo's a good example, who are not interested in this sort of thing. And there are certainly people who think it doesn't work or is silly. But this sort of material pervades a great deal of mainstream scientific and philosophical discourse. So from our point of view, to sort of separate it out means taking a particular side that leads to strange readings of some of these figures.
Okay, so if I were plopped down in the 16th century Europe and I started talking to A, ordinary people, B, priests and religious believers, and the people who were sort of like scientists, alchemy and astrology, and they would just be everybody? This would just suffuse the culture? Is that correct, that these occult beliefs, what we now call, did they just suffuse the culture?
Well, it sort of depends on which particular thing you're talking about. I mean, so for example, astrology is something that has been criticized, you know, for 2,000 years. Certainly, on the other hand, you have somebody like Girolamo Cardano, who's a very distinguished astrologer, kind of advisor to kings and so forth, and quite a serious scholar, but he's not a scientist by a modern sense. Alchemy goes in and out of fashion depending on where and when you are. Paracelsus, who dies in 1541, has this tremendous impact. But the man himself, I mean, gets drummed out of Basel for burning the works of Avicenna publicly. So it sort of depends.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure I got the picture. I'm trying to figure out if the occult mindset was like the European mindset, if it was a minority thing, if it was warring with the religious mindset. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, how culturally dominant and prevalent a belief in the occult and these occult things were.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that I think you're misconstructing the question.
Okay.
That is to say, you're saying, okay, here's this category that we know, the occult, right? And how much of it do we see in this period? They don't really have the category. So it ends up being a false question. It's an anachronistic approach. We sort of impose our model onto them. I don't think they see it quite that way.
If we went back and looked at the three major Western religions, that is to say Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, are there significant differences in the sympathy to things that, looking back, we now regard as occult?
I can't speak to Islam so much. Certainly with Judaism and then various types of Christianity, you do get tremendous variation. Jewish mystical traditions, Kabbalistic traditions, can these days people will tend to separate out magical material from it and sort of say, well, this is mysticism, so it's okay. Within the Catholic tradition, well, you have to remember that Luther and Calvin said that Catholic sacramentalism was magic because, you know, they believe in transubstantiation. You say, you know, magic words and all of a sudden, you know, wafer and wine becomes body and blood. So, I mean, this is obviously a criticism. But on the other hand, Paracelsus is a good Protestant and so is Newton. So
when did magic become I'll ask you another kind of question. When did magic become a bad word? That is a term of, oh, that's magical thinking, right? As a criticism. How did that become a bad word?
Certainly Luther and Calvin get that ball rolling pretty strongly. And you'll see by the end of the 17th century the increasing separation out of magic as in particular something problematic. But then it's really not until well into the Enlightenment that you start using terms like magic or occult to encompass things like astrology and alchemy and so forth. Those are really seen as quite different things.
Now, my dad was a Mason, a 32nd degree Mason. I have no idea what that means. But was Masonry somehow involved in all of this? I believe also our founding fathers tended to belong to the Masons.
Sure. Freemasonry is really an 18th century movement. It draws on some of these earlier occult philosophical kind of correspondences and things like this. But it's very much also a political philosophy and a kind of attempt to model the perfect state and this sort of thing on principles of sympathy and correspondence. But you have to remember that by the late 18th century, everybody who's anybody is a Mason. I mean, Mozart and Goethe and Lessing and, yes, the Founding Fathers and so forth. But that's really, it would almost be surprising if most of the Founding Fathers weren't Masons, because anybody who's interested in liberal, progressive, Enlightenment ideals, but also is a bit of an elitist and thinks that, you know, pure democracy isn't necessarily the greatest idea, is likely to be finding Masonry congenial.
Maybe I better join.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the occult philosophy of the Renaissance, which seems to have lasted even beyond the Renaissance. And we're joined now by George from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, George.
Hi. I hope that you host recognize that you yourselves are actively practicing magicians.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
I like to cast spell on my students, but what do you mean by that?
I'll take that as a compliment, yeah.
All right. Now, first, if you want the background, it's a book called Making Magic by Randall Stiers, S-T-Y-E-R-S. Essentially, his argument is that people who are interested in words, in naming, in the creation of technical vocabularies, are attempting to defend themselves against the chaos of the universe by producing magical and controlling order, which is exactly what you guys are doing.
Well, George, well, thanks for that insight. Christopher, what do you think about George's insight?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a little simplistic. The point is well taken. A great deal of magic, certainly in the Western tradition, is about words and the ordering and intersection of words and the power of words. I do think that with modern philosophy, there's at least a strong attempt to, well, at least suppress the notion that one's words are anything other than relations to some sort of logical concepts in your mind rather than touching something else.
Right.
But the point's well taken.
So as I understand Kabbalah, I'm not an adept or and practitioner or knowledgeable about many of these things, except to the extent that I worked hard to prepare for this show. So as I understand Kabbalah, back to words, it has something to do with the names for things are somehow encoded somehow in the Hebrew scriptures, and you have this technique of deciphering them so you learn the true names for things and thereby gain power. Is that roughly right? I'm willing to be corrected.
Yeah, no, there's truth to that. And thereby gain power, well, that gets very controversial, whether that's really a reasonable interpretation of Jewish or Christian Kabbalah, which are quite different things. But yeah, I mean, the notion is that, again, we have the Adamic language, you know, Adam names everything. And the Jewish claim certainly is that that's in Hebrew. And so when you have the fall of the Tower of Babel, every language shatters, but Hebrew retains this power that, to some degree, we don't have perfect access to except through Scripture, except through the Torah, which was written by God before the creation. I mean, it, in a sense, is the creation. So when you're reading Torah, you're reading the work of God quite directly in a very fundamental sense. And this means that very close examination of how letters and numbers intersect in that text is reading the mind of God. With Christian Kabbalah, that moves out of a more purely, or not purely, but a more dominantly mystical frame and into a more sort of proto-scientific frame of trying to correlate this against the book of nature and this sort of thing. So finding something in the text that will somehow explain or correlate with something you find in the natural world and vice versa.
So I'm a little sympathetic with what our caller George said and maybe what this fellow Randall Steyer says. There's two things in philosophy today that strike me as kind of messing with the occult. I'll just throw them out and maybe Ken can attack me or or Chris. But one is kind of the neo-rationalism. I mean, rationalism kind of goes back to Plato, and it's the idea that there is this underworld. It's not quite in the occult world in the way we've been thinking of it, but it's the world of numbers and the world. It's the world that, you know, we're locked in a cave, and you get out of the cave, and you connect up with this real world. And we have a lot of colleagues, Ken, that think they're connecting with the real world of essences and possible worlds and structures of possible worlds and a priori knowledge and proving what the mind is like that way. Doesn't that strike you as a little occultist?
Well, it strikes me as, I mean, well, there is a lot of metaphysical speculation.
Of course, you and I aren't like that. Yeah, we deal with a messy world as it comes.
Yeah, I deal with a messy world as it comes, but there is a lot of metaphysical speculation, even in philosophy today, about, you know, hidden realities, hidden forms, and all that sort of stuff. But is that deeply connected to the occult philosophy of the Renaissance, that kind of worrying?
Well, I tend to think that it should be connected, but I have not actually seen the sort of people that you're talking about paying any attention to the couple, three centuries of really serious speculation about this. You tend to say, no, we don't need any of that, so we'll just sort of evolve it from nothing.
It's true,
though. So, yeah, the overlap is considerable. I mean, again, Kepler is really fascinated by the third law because it doesn't predict anything and it doesn't describe anything, but it's about numbers
so
and
let me,
how they
let
relate.
Me, let me ask you a question, then. So you say it's a late thing where scientific, what we now call scientific rationality, separated out from this whole blooming, buzzing community. What happened there? I mean, here's an amateur hypothesis. It's partly the influence of Protestant and Catholicism rejecting this stuff as dark, and it was partly the emergence of the scientific revolution shredding parts of this stuff, and somehow the two of them combined to marginalize. But I don't know if that's right or wrong. Tell me how you think about it.
There's a good deal of truth in that. I think a strong example would be the collapse of astrology. Once you have the Copernican revolution really fixed solidly after Kepler, the whole foundation of it goes away, because in the Aristotelian Ptolemaic universe, I mean, astrology is predictable. It's sort of an obvious part of how the universe must work. Certainly, if you have all these good claims, you know, thousands of years of people saying it works, then it must be true. Once you have a completely different universe, the mechanism is gone. And now you're in the modern position of saying, give me one good piece of evidence that any of this is true. So it's a sort of paradigm shift that has this side effect of destroying astrology. I think that kind of thing is true with a lot of what you might call the occult sciences. But then you have this odd case of Newton, who really is a very serious alchemist, and thinks that in gravity he has found evidence of the active principle that Paracelsus and so forth had been talking about. We just don't like to talk about that anymore. We don't want to think of Newton that way.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the occult philosophy of the Renaissance with Christopher Larrick from Boston University. And we're joined now by Meredith from Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Meredith.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, from my reading, I have come to the conclusion that occult power derives its power. I mean, this is how I think of it, by seeing the creation of words and points of view as more like a sense, so that the words do not just describe something, but they actually create something. They create a world. So that the power is in the creation, they're more so in that way. They're more like sight or hearing or touch or so on. They're one of the ways in which the world is actually created, manifests itself. I'd like some comment on that.
Oh, thanks, Meredith. So, you had a thought about that, Christopher?
Well, I'm not quite sure what's being proposed. I mean, language as a sense. Well, I suppose, but. If we're talking about perceiving the world in meaningful terms, I mean that in the sort of technical sense of making meaning out of what we perceive and using language to do that, yes, but there's quite a difference between that and going the other way around. That is to say, of building a world and actually essentially imposing it
right.
on what you see around
you.
I
take it that the practitioners of occult philosophy believe that the world was created by a divine being and that they were trying to understand, in some sense, the mind of the divine or something like that. Is that roughly right or not?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly how Newton talks.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the occult philosophy with Christopher Larrick, author of The Occult Mind, Magic in Theory and Practice.
In our final segment, we'll discuss whether a sober, scientific person in the 21st century can still believe in the occult. Why or why not?
The occult in the new millennium, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Abracadabra, hocus pocus, alakazam. Is there more to occult than mystery and magic? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Christopher Larrick. So, Christopher, I want to ask you, we talked about how science separated, but I want to ask you a religious thing. Why were witches persecuted throughout this, so-called witches persecuted? I mean, that suggests to me that there was some kind of religious reaction against the occult philosophies, too. Is that right or wrong?
I tend to think that the witchcraft persecutions and the occult philosophy the connection is very strange and tenuous. It's not direct at all. People are not claiming that witches are the same as occult philosophers. I mean, you don't have a whole lot of examples of significant occult philosophers and magicians being persecuted and burned and that sort of thing. It just doesn't really come up. Witches are really a different matter entirely.
So, well, what is the
Satanists?
What is the matter? Well, who are they and what are they? I mean. So, because a lot of people, when they think of witches, they think of that as a form of religious persecution, had something to do with paganism, satanic practices, or something. What's all that?
Well, Satanism certainly. I mean, the idea that the witches being persecuted, and you know, it's about 200,000 people executed.
Well, that's a lot.
The idea that they're pagans is very unlikely. I mean, there's just very little evidence for it. Basically, you have this notion that there's this kind of satanic conspiracy all over Europe that's destabilizing everything, and we have to root them out. And then there are all kinds of legal and other abuses that tend to make the whole thing cascade.
So there's this movement in America a little later than that. The thing that kind of cropped up with Christian Science and a lot of. Interest in the paranormal and the idea that the mind has all kinds of powers that it's not given credit for. Is that connected to the Renaissance and the occult, or is that just a kind of 19th and early 20th century American phenomenon?
No, and it's not only American either. I mean, England is an important nexus for this, as is France. I mean, essentially, in the 19th century, you have what's sometimes called the occult revival, in which people like Eliphas Levi and William Butler Yeats and people like this are essentially trying to revive this kind of Renaissance occult philosophy. And they've got this new language that it's against science because science doesn't know anything, that's all materialist and all that sort of thing. And that then feeds into the later kind of reinvention of things like pagan witchcraft and so forth, which is sort of turn of the 20th century.
Now, Abraham Lincoln had seances in the White House. I don't know how seriously he took them. Nancy Reagan used astrologers to advise her husband. But has the occult really had much influence in practical and political affairs in America?
Sarah from Alaska wants to know an answer to that question, I think. She's written us an email about that. So what do you think, Christopher?
Well, it depends on what you mean. I mean, obviously, Freemasonry. There's not really a lot of question about that. But whether you can really call that occult philosophy in any strong sense, I'm a little bit skeptical. Certainly in the late 19th century, spiritualism of various types, so speaking with the dead through seances, is fairly mainstream. And there you have Mrs. Lincoln, for example. My impression is that President Lincoln actually thought it was kind of silly, but, you know, he wasn't going to be rude to his wife. But when you start getting astrology and so forth, now, if it's there, you don't hear a lot about it. I don't think it's a strong influence anymore.
That raises a kind of question. I mean, maybe people in high places and high power won't admit to their beliefs. I mean, in the occult, Nancy Reagan's consulting an astrologer, for example, was scandalous, as I recall, and was some sign that maybe Reagan really wasn't with it all, you know. But I think a lot of people still do believe in the occult. But you said something about how we've had this paradigm shift. Can a rational scientific person, you know, a scientifically minded person in the 21st century have any grounds for believing in this stuff? Or has it just become so marginalized that only those who are ultra out there could possibly believe in it? What do you think?
For me, I think it depends on which particular form we're talking about. So astrology, I think the question that any modern scientist will ask, which is, you know, why should I add these forces to a perfectly consistent astronomical and material universe, is a very good question. I think in the 16th century, it's a terrible question. It doesn't make any sense because it's obvious within the Ptolemaic framework. Alchemy, I mean, we just have a theory of matter that works so well that it's very difficult to see why alchemical transmutation ought to work. I mean, Newton was wrong about that. But to be honest, really serious astrological claims would be very difficult to actually falsify.
Yeah, so, okay, but so it sounds like you're focusing on the particular occult scientist. I'm thinking of spooky stuff in general. Is that just for the superstitious mind? You know, this idea that there's a connection between the divine and the book of nature, the book of God, and that we could somehow, by studying these ancient texts in these ancient ways, get at something that modern science leaves off. You don't think there's anything to that thought?
Not especially. I mean, I think there's some, but I mean, I think the big issue there is that antagonism. I mean, that drives a huge amount, this notion that, oh, well, society today is entirely materialistic, and so they don't know things, and we have this spiritual knowledge and so forth. And then that knowledge cannot be submitted to any sort of empirical analysis or testing because, well, if you don't believe in it, you'll never understand and so forth. It's kind of a dead end. If you give me some way to investigate it, some way to analyze it, then we'll talk. But I don't see a lot of that.
I think we have a caller who wants the pushback on you. Deborah from San Francisco is joining us now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Deborah.
Hi. I'm glad to be able to talk for the other side of this philosophic issue, simply because there is a lot of information available and a lot of people who have experiences directly with powers that are difficult for science to explain. And, for instance, there is the ability of Tibetan monks through vocal manipulations to move large physical objects, and that has been observed. There is also an 8-volume book that was published published by a man who worked with the first Bishop Museum in Hawaii's museum director, who had spent 30 years of his life, and the man who wrote the book had spent 20 years of his life, and they collaborated on breaking the code of the Huna religion to understand how the kahunas were able to walk on lava, raise the dead, change the weather patterns, and do things that were completely illogical, which they all witnessed firsthand.
Okay, Deborah, thank you for the input and then the challenge to Christopher. You got anything to say in response to Deborah, Christopher?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that certainly there are phenomena of various kinds that are not well explained and well accounted for. I'm not going to come up with some particular list of which ones I think are likely and which ones aren't. I don't know. But certainly there is some truth to the sort of, well, you know, science doesn't know these things, in the sense that it is true that an awful lot of scientists approach anything like this simply through debunking. There's no attempt to understand, grapple with. But that said, the antagonism doesn't entail that the phenomena, A, are real, and B, cannot be explained in terms of modern scientific paradigms. I think that's a very, a fallacious conception.
And I think one big difference between science and these ancient practices is that science has this kind of self-correcting character. It doesn't take its things as given and unquestionable. And some people who believe in some of these occult practices think they're revealed and unquestionable. John, you want to get
well,
the last
word in here? Well, we've gotten quite a bit of good email. Let me just briefly summarize some before we go. Mike Kemper says, I believe the opening lines of the Bible go, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was from God. I think that's actually the book of John, yes. But at any rate, it seems to have that spirit. Nate says, hi, good show. I think a lot of people like the occult because it's not Christianity. And then Greg Slater has a rather long email. I can't read all of it, but it's got a very good point, and one I think you've brought out, that the occult studies occurred during the infancy of the development of genuine scientific method, and they didn't really know what they were doing. And so now we have a division into that which is truly scientific and that which is not, but it shouldn't go back and blame Newton, because at that point the scientific method didn't exist as it does today. At least it wasn't understood. So thanks to our emailers.
So, Christopher, give us your last closing thoughts on this really fascinating topic. What do you want to leave our audience with?
Well, I think that last letter opens a very interesting question, in that I think Newton and many of the other great occult philosophers, and I think Newton was one, would have said that science has made a wrong turn here, in the sense that science has said, okay, we're only going to look at the material world and we will refuse to look at spiritual questions, religious questions. And I think for Newton, that just makes it all useless.
So on that note, Christopher, I'm going to thank you for joining us. You've been a great guest. It's been a scintillating, really spiritual conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Christopher Larrick. He's a professor of religion at Boston University. He's author of the very fine book, The Occult Mind, Magic in Theory and in Practice. So, John, this has been a great conversation. We can't get into it much more, but it continues on our blog, as always, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can also participate in our Facebook page, where we've got thousands and thousands of listeners, fans or likers or whatever they're called now.
You know, it's been fascinating. I've had a little brush with some of the occult dimensions in these philosophers, but not much. I learned a lot today. I'm very thankful for Christopher for doing that. But, you know, you can download podcasts of our program from our website, so we don't need to remain occult to you. And now we're going to reveal the hidden essence of a movie. Let's take Philosophy Talk to the movies.
Today we're going to talk about the great movie Inception, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Ellen Page, and written and directed by Christopher Nolan, one of the most philosophically profound directors in Hollywood. He wrote one of my all-time philosophically favorite movie, Memento. He did The Dark Knight, which is also philosophically profound.
Memento deals with memory. This one deals with dreams, both philosophically very rich subjects. In this movie, Leonardo DiCaprio is a professional dream manipulator.
You never really remember the beginning of a dream, do you? You always wind up right in the middle of what's going on.
I guess, yeah.
So how did we end up here?
Well, we just came from the,
Think about it, Ariadne. How did you get here? Where are you right now?
We're dreaming.
You're actually in the middle of the workshop right now, sleeping. This is your first lesson in shared dreaming. Stay calm.
just that alone, before we get to some of the deeper issues in the movie, is metaphysically puzzling. You think of a dream as a private thing, right? And the difference between dreaming and reality, how do I know I'm not just dreaming? Well, one thing is all these other people out there share this reality. Dreams are private realities. And when a dream becomes a shared thing, it makes that question even more puzzling.
Now, when I was a kid, I was taught that if you're not sure whether you're dreaming or not, pinch yourself. Descartes said something similar after worrying in the first and the second meditation about whether he was dreaming. He said at the end, well, it's not that hard to tell because dreams are so weird.
You create the world of the dream. We bring the subject into that dream, and they fill it with their subconscious.
How could I ever acquire enough detail to make them think that it's reality?
Well, dreams, they feel real while we're in them, right? It's only when we wake up that we realize something is actually strange.
And then they've got dreams within dreams and the whole problem of time. We all know from our dreams that dreams move faster in some sense than real life, because you accomplish a lot in a dream when you may have just been taking a half an hour nap. But in this movie, they have dreams within dreams, and it turns out that the dreams within dreams move faster than the dreams that they're within.
The dreams within dreams are not just, I'm dreaming that I'm dreaming that I'm dreaming, but they also think, it also represents the dreams within dreams as kind of getting deeper and deeper and deeper to the unconscious. And that ability to get deeper into the hidden reaches of the mind and manipulated and constructed is an important thing about the plot of the movie. Because these guys first start out, they want to steal ideas from people by exploring their unconscious through dreams. But the point of this movie is not to steal an idea, John, but it's to plant an idea.
The word inception refers to the task that Leonardo DiCaprio is set to not only find out what's going on in somebody's mind by getting into their dream and sharing a dream with them, but actually implant an idea that's to the benefit of his employer, that is to Leonardo DiCaprio's employer. Inception is a big challenge, and the movie's about how they pull it off.
You're going to have to be completely open with me. I need to know my way around your thoughts better than your wife, better than your therapist, better than anyone. If this is a dream and you have a safe full of secrets, I need to know what's in that safe. In order for this all to work, you need to completely let me in.
So one of the things that Nolan is contemplating is, where do ideas come from? I mean, sometimes they just appear to us as if out of nowhere, but the suggestion is, no, deep in our unconscious, subconscious, there's all this stuff happening, all this turmoil and tension, and it bubbles up to consciousness as an idea. And one of the things this movie is exploring is the deep subterranean roots of the genesis of our ideas. It's really amazing. It takes on all kinds of issues. The border between reality and dreams, the nature of the unconscious, how ideas are produced out of unconscious processes that we're not aware of. And it also takes on this issue of the nature of memory. His movie, Memento, was all about the nature of memory. And memory comes back here as a theme too, John.
I think Inception, like Memento, and like the movie Matrix, is going to be one of these movies that appears in philosophy courses about skepticism, philosophy courses that are devoted to great philosophical thrillers. It's really quite a good movie from the philosophical point of view. It's consistent, coherent, and raises interesting questions.
It's the chance to build cathedrals, entire cities, things that never existed, things that couldn't exist in the real world. I need an architect who's as good as I was.
I've got somebody better.
The movie is Inception, written and produced and directed by Christopher Nolan, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Ellen Page.
Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in their own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Thank you.